The Fraud of Feminism by E. Belfort Bax. Part 6. The Chivalry Fake. The justification for the whole movement of modern feminism, in one of its main practical aspects, namely the placing of the female sex in the position of privilege, advantage, and immunity, is concentrated in the current conception of chivalry. It behooves us, therefore, to devote some consideration to the meaning and implication of this notion. Now, this word chivalry is the dernier resort of those at a loss for a justification of the modern privileging of women, but those who use it seldom give themselves the trouble to analyse the connotations of this term. Brought to book as to its meaning, most persons would probably define it as a deference to, or consideration for, weakness, especially bodily weakness. Used in this sense, however, the term covers a very much wider ground than the kowtowing to the female section of the human race usually associated with it. Boys, men whose muscular strength is below the average, domestic animals, etc., might all claim this special protection as a plea of chivalry in their favour, and yet we do not find different criminal laws, or different rules of prison treatment, say, for men whose stamina is below the average. Neither do we find such men or boys exempted by law from corporal punishment in consequence of their weakness, unless, as an exception, in individual cases when the weakness amounts to dangerous physical disability. Neither, again, in the general affairs of life, are we accustomed to see any such deference to men of weaker muscular or constitutional development as custom exacts in the case of women. Once more, looking at the question from the other side, do we find the claim of chivalry dropped in the case of the powerful virago or the muscularly developed female athlete, the sportswoman who rides, hunts, plays cricket, football, golf and other masculine games, and who may even fence or box? Not one whit. It would seem, then, that the definition of the term under consideration, based on the notion of deference to mere weakness as such, will hardly hold water, since in its application the question of sex always takes precedence of that of weakness. Let us try again, abandoning for the moment the definition of chivalry as a consideration for weakness, considered absolutely, as we may term it. Let us see whether the definition of consideration for relative defencelessness, i.e. defencelessness in a given situation, will coincide with the current usage of the word. But here again, we are met with the fact that the man in the hands of the law, to wit, in the grip of the forces of the state, aye, even the strongest man, were he a very Hercules, is in as precisely a defenceless and helpless a position, relative to those in whose power he finds himself, as the weakest woman would be, in the like case, neither more nor less. Yet an enlightened and chivalrous public opinion tolerates the most fiendish barbarities and excogitated cruelties being perpetrated upon male convicts in our jails, while it shudders with horror at the notion of female convicts being accorded any severity of punishment at all, even for the same, or for that matter, more heinous offences. A particularly crass and crucial illustration is that infamous piece of one-sided sex legislation, which has already occupied our attention in the course of the present volume, to wit, the so-called White Slave Traffic Act of 1912. It is plain, then, that chivalry as understood in the present day really spells sex privilege and sex favouritism, pure and simple, and that any attempts to define the term on a larger basis, or to give it a colourable rationality founded on fact, are simply subterfuges, conscious or unconscious, on the part of those who put them forward. The etymology of the word chivalry is well known, And obvious enough, the term meant originally the virtues associated with knighthood considered as a whole, bravery even to the extent of reckless daring, loyalty to the chief or feudal superior, generosity to a fallen foe, general open-handedness and open-heartedness, including, of course, the succour of the weak and the oppressed generally, inter alia, their female sex when in difficulties. It would be idle, of course, to insist upon the historical definition of the term. Language develops, and words in course of time depart widely from their original connotation, so that etymology alone is seldom of much value in practically determining the definition of words in their application at the present day. But the fact is nonetheless worthy of note that only a fragment of the original connotation of the word chivalry is covered by the term as used in our time, and that even that fragment is torn from its original connection and is made to serve as a scarecrow in the field of public opinion to intimidate all who refuse to act upon or who protest against the privileges and immunities of the female sex. I have said that even that subsidiary element in the old original notion of chivalry, which is now well nigh the only surviving remnant of its original connotation, is torn from its connection and hence has necessarily become radically changed in its meaning. From being part of a general code of manners enjoined upon a particular guild or profession, it has been degraded to mean the exclusive right in one sex, guaranteed by law and custom, to certain advantages and exemptions without any corresponding responsibility. Let us make no mistake about this. When the limelight of a little plain but critical common sense is turned upon this notion of chivalry, hitherto regarded as so sacrosanct, it is seen to be but a poor thing after all. And when men have acquired the habit of habitually turning the light of such criticism upon it, the accusation, so terrible in the present state of public opinion, of being unchivalrous, will lose its terrors for them. In the so-called ages of chivalry themselves, it never meant, as it does today, the woman, right or wrong. It never meant, as it does today, the general legal and social privilege of sex. It never meant a social defence or a legal exoneration for the bad and even the criminal woman, simply because she is a woman. It meant none of these things. All it meant was a voluntary or gratuitous personal service to the forlorn women which the members of the Knights Guild, among other such services, many of them taking precedence of this one, were supposed to perform. So far as courage is concerned, which was perhaps the first of the chivalric virtues in the old days, it certainly requires more courage in our days to deal severely with a woman when she deserves it, as a man would be dealt with in like circumstances, than it does to back up a woman against her wicked male opponent. It is a cheap thing, for example, in the case of a man and woman quarrelling in the street, to play out the stage role of the bold and gallant Englishman who won't see a woman maltreated and put upon, no, not he, and this, of course, without any inquiry into the merits of the quarrel. To swim with the stream, to make a pretence of boldness and bravery, when all the time you know you have the backing of conventional public opinion and mob force behind you, is the cheapest of mock heroics. Chivalry today means the woman, right or wrong, just as patriotism today means my country, right or wrong. In other words, chivalry today is just another name for sentimental feminism. Every outrageous pretension of sentimental feminism can be justified by the appeal to chivalry, which amounts, to use the German expression, to an appeal from Pontius to Pilate. This sentimental feminism, commonly called chivalry, is sometimes impudently dubbed by its votaries manliness. It will presumably continue in its practical effects until a sufficient minority of sensible men will have the moral courage to beard a feminist public opinion and shed a little of this sort of manliness. The plucky Welshmen at Llandysem Dwy, in their dealings with the suffragette rowdies on a memorable occasion, showed themselves capable of doing this. In fact, one good effect, generally, of militant suffragettism seems to be the weakening of the notion of chivalry, i.e. in its modern sense of sentimental feminism, among the populace of this country. The combination of sentimental feminism with its invocation of the old world sentiment of chivalry, which was based essentially on the assumption of the mental, moral, and physical inferiority of woman to man for its justification, with the pretensions of modern political feminism, is simply grotesque in its inconsistent absurdity. In this way, modern feminism would fain achieve the feat of eating its cake and having it too. When political and economic rights are in question, bien entendu, such as involve gain and social standing, the assumption of inferiority magically disappears before the strident assertion of the dogma of the equality of woman with man, her mental and moral equality certainly. When, however, the question is of a different character, for example, for the relieving of some vile female criminal of the penalty of her misdeeds, then sentimental feminism comes into play. Then the whole plaidoyer is based on the chivalric sentiment of deference and consideration for the poor, weak woman. I may point out that here, if it be in the least degree logical, the plea for mercy or immunity can hardly be based on any other consideration than that of an intrinsic moral weakness, in view of which the offence is to be condoned. The plea of physical weakness, if such be entertained, is here, as in most cases, purely irrelevant. Thus, as regards the commutation of the death sentence, the question of the muscular strength or weakness of the condemned person does not come in at all. The same applies, mutatis mutandis, to many other forms of criminal punishment. But it must not be forgotten that there are two aspects of physical strength or weakness. There is, as we have already pointed out, the muscular aspect and the constitutional aspect. If we concede the female sex as essentially and inherently weaker in muscular power and development than the male, this by no means involves the assumption that woman is constitutionally weaker than man. On the contrary, it is a known fact, attested, as far as I am aware, by all physiologists, no less than by common observation, that the constitutional toughness and power of endurance of woman in general far exceeds that of man, as has already been explained earlier. This resilient power of the system, its capacity for enduring strain, it may here be remarked in passing, is by no means necessarily a characteristic of a specially high stage of organic evolution. We find it, indeed, in many orders of invertebrate animals in striking forms. Be this as it may, however, the existence of this greater constitutional strength or resistant power in the female than in the male organic system, as crucially instanced by the markedly greater death rate of boys than of girls in infancy and early childhood, should, in respect of severity of punishment, prison treatment, etc., be a strong counter-argument against the plea for leniency or immunity in the case of female criminals made by the advocates of sentimental feminism. But these considerations afford only one more illustration of the utter irrationality of the whole movement of sentimental feminism, identified with the notion of chivalry. For the rest, we may find illustrations of this galore. A very flagrant case is that infamous Rule of the Sea, which came so much into prominence at the time of the Titanic disaster. According to this preposterous chivalric feminism, in the case of a ship foundering, it is the unwritten law of the seas, not that the passengers shall leave the ship and be rescued in their order as they come, but that the whole female portion shall have the right of being rescued before any man is allowed to leave the ship, Now this abominable piece of sex favouritism, on the face of it, cries aloud in its irrational injustice. Here is no question of bodily strength or weakness, either muscular or constitutional. In this respect, for the nonce, all are on a level, but it is a case of life itself. A number of poor wretches are doomed to a watery grave, simply and solely because they have not had the luck to be born of the privileged female sex. Such is chivalry, as understood today, the deprivation, the robbery from men of the most elementary personal rights in order to endow women with privilege at the expense of men. During the ages of chivalry, and for long after it, it was not so. Law and custom then was the same for men as for women in its incidence. To quote the familiar proverb in a slightly altered form, then what was sauce for the gander was sauce for the goose. Not until the 19th century did this state of things change. Then, for the first time, the law began to respect persons and to distinguish in favour of sex. Even taking the matter on the conventional ground of weakness and granting, for the sake of argument, the relative muscular weakness of the female, as ground for her being allowed the immunity claimed by modern feminists of the sentimental school, the distinction is altogether lost sight of between weakness as such and aggressive weakness. Now I submit, there is a considerable difference between what is due to weakness that is harmless and unprovocative, and weakness that is aggressive. Still more, when this aggressive weakness presumes on itself as weakness, and on the consideration extended to it, in order to become tyrannical and oppressive. Weakness, as such, assuredly deserves all consideration, but aggressive weakness deserves none save to be crushed beneath the iron heel of strength. Woman, at the present day, has been encouraged by a feminist public opinion to become meanly aggressive under the protection of her weakness. She has been encouraged to forge her gift of weakness into a weapon of tyranny against man, unwitting that in so doing she has deprived her weakness of all just claim to consideration or even to toleration.
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
Now we come to some feminist lies and fallacies. By feminist lies, I understand false statements put forward by persons, many of whom should be perfectly well aware that they are false, apparently with the deliberate intention of misleading public opinion as to the real position of woman before the law. By fallacies, I understand statements doubtless dictated by feminist prepossessions or feminist bias, but not necessarily suggesting conscious or deliberate maleficence. Of the first order, the statements are made apparently with intentional dishonesty, insofar as many of the persons making them are concerned, since we may reasonably suppose them to have intelligence and knowledge enough to be aware that they are contrary to fact. The talk about the wife being a chattel, for example, is so palpably absurd in the face of the existing law that it is nowadays scarcely worth making, although we do hear it occasionally, even now. But it was not even true under the old common law of England, which for certain disabilities on the one hand, conceded to the wife certain corresponding privileges on the other. The law of husband and wife, as modified by statute in the course of the 19th century, as I have often enough had occasion to point out, is a monument of legalised tyranny over the husband in the interests of the wife. If, in the face of the facts, the word chattel, as applied to the wife, has become a little too preposterous, even for feminist controversial methods, there is another falsehood scarcely less brazen that we hear from feminist fanatics every day. The wife, we are told, is the only unpaid servant. A more blatant lie could scarcely be imagined, as every educated person possessing the slightest acquaintance with the laws of England knows the law requires the husband to maintain his wife in a manner according with his own social position. He has, in other words, to feed, clothe, and afford her all reasonable luxuries, which the law, with a view to the economic standing of the husband, regards as necessaries. This, although the husband has no claim on the wife's property or income, however wealthy she may be. Furthermore, it needs scarcely be said, a servant who is inefficient, lazy, or otherwise intolerable can be dismissed, or her wage can be lowered. Not so that privileged person, the legally wedded wife. It matters not whether she performs her duties well, badly, indifferently, or not at all. The husband's legal obligations remain just the same. It will be seen, therefore, that the wife, in any case, receives from the husband economic advantages, compared with which the wages of the most highly paid servant in existence are a mere pauper's pittance. This talk we hear ad nauseam from the feminist side of the wife being an unpaid servant is typical of the whole feminist agitation. We find the same deliberate and unscrupulous dishonesty characterizing it throughout. Facts are not merely perverted or exaggerated, they are simply turned upside down. Another statement, commonly made, is that women's lower wages, as compared with men's, is a result of not possessing the parliamentary franchise. Now this statement, though not perhaps bearing on its face the wilful deception characterizing the one just mentioned, is not any the less a perversion of economic fact, and we can hardly regard it otherwise than as intentional. It is quite clear that up to date the wages of men have not been raised by legislation, and yet sections of the working classes have possessed the franchise at least since 1867. What legislation has done for the men has been simply to remove obstacles in the way of industrial organisation on the part of the workman in freeing the trade unions from disabilities, and even this was begun, owing to working class pressure from outside, long before, as long ago as the 20s of the last century, under the auspices of Joseph Hume and Francis Place. Now women's unions enjoy precisely the same freedom as men's unions, and nothing stands in the way of working women organising and agitating for higher wages. Those who talk of the voting franchise as being necessary for working women in order to obtain equal industrial and economic advantages with working men must realise perfectly well that they are performing the oratorical operation colloquially known as talking through their hat. The reasons why the wages of women workers are lower than those of men, whatever else may be their grounds, and these are, I think, pretty obvious, clearly are not traceable to anything which the concession of the franchise would remove. If it be suggested that a law could be enacted compulsorily enforcing equal rates of payment for women as for men, what the result would be, the merest tyro in such matters can foresee, to wit, that it would mean the wholesale displacement of female by male labour over large branches of industry, and this, we imagine, is not precisely what the advocates of female suffrage are desirous of effecting. Male labour, owing to its greater efficiency and other causes, being generally preferred by employers to female labour, it is not likely that, even for the sake of female boyaux, they are going to accept female labour in the place of male on an equal wage basis. All this, of course, is quite apart from the question referred to in a previous podcast as to the economic responsibilities in the interests of women, which our feminist lawmakers have saddled on the man, namely the responsibility of the husband and the husband alone for the maintenance of his wife and family, obligations from anything corresponding to which the female sex is wholly free. In a leaflet issued by the Men's Federation for Women's Suffrage, it is affirmed that many laws are on the statute book which inflict injustice upon women. We challenge this statement as an unmitigated falsehood. Its makers ought to know perfectly well that they cannot justify it. There are no laws on the statute book inflicting injustice on women as a sex, but there are many laws inflicting injustice on men in the supposed interests of women. The worn-out tag, which has so long done duty with feminists in this connection, viz. The rule of the divorce court, that in order to procure divorce, a wife has to prove cruelty as well as adultery on the part of a husband, whereas a husband has to prove adultery alone on the part of a wife, has already been dealt with, and its rottenness as a specimen of a grievance sufficiently exposed in this work and elsewhere by the present writer. Is what the authors of the leaflet may possibly have in their mind, if they have anything at all, when they talk about statutes inflicting injustice on women, that the law does not carry sex vindictiveness against men far enough to please them. With all its flogging, penal servitude, hard labour, and the rest, for offences against women, some of them of a comparatively trivial kind, does the law as regards severity on men not even yet satisfy the ferocious feminist souls of the members of the Men's Federation for Women's Suffrage? This is the only explanation of the statement in question, other than that it is sheer bold bluff, designed to mislead those ignorant of the law. Another flagrant falsehood, perpetually being dinned into our ears by the suffragists, is the statement that women have to obey the same laws as men. The conclusion drawn from this false statement is, of course, that since they have to obey these laws equally with men, they have an equal claim with men to take part in the making or the modifying of them. Now, without pausing to consider the fallacy underlying the conclusion, we would point out that it is sufficient for our present purpose to call attention to the falsity of the initial assumption in itself. It needs only one who follows current events and reads his newspaper with an impartial mind to see that to allege that women have to, in the true sense of the words, i.e. are compelled to, obey the same laws as men, is a glaringly mendacious statement. It is unnecessary in this place to go over once more the mass of evidence comprised in previous writings of my own. For example, in the pamphlet, The Legal Subjection of Men, in the article, A Creature of Privilege, and elsewhere, in these present podcasts, which illustrate the unquestionable fact that though in theory women may have to obey the law as men have, yet in practice they are absolved from all the more serious consequences men have to suffer when they disobey it. The treatment recently accorded to the suffragettes for crimes such as willful damage and arson, not to speak of their previous prison treatment when convicted for obstruction, disturbance and minor police misdemeanours, is a proof, writ large, of the mendacity of the statement that women no less than men have to obey the laws of the country, so far, that is, as any real meaning is attached to this phrase.